This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This month on Late Night Woman's Hour, winter is coming. Without wishing to get too Game of Thrones about it, the nights are drawing in and so are more of us. Our subject this month is home. Are you creating a nest to hibernate for the winter? What does home mean to you? And why has the Scandinavian art of hygge become the word of the season? Genius marketing or emotional need? Joining me tonight, podcaster and crafter Helen Zaltzman. Hello, Helen.
Hello.
Rachel Hurdley, Research Fellow in the School of Social Science at Cardiff University. Welcome.
Hello.
Susie Orbach, psychotherapist and author. Hello to you.
Hello.
And Trina Hahnemann, chef and author. Welcome, Trina.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for joining me all. So, hygge is the latest confusingly spelled domestic trend to hit the UK, imported from Scandinavia. You've probably seen it written down, and it's spelled H-Y-G-G-E. Should you wish to read about it further, you currently have over 100 volumes to choose from on one popular book website. There's hygge home decor, hygge food, hygge parenting, even a hygge colouring book, which I presume you have to do by a fire wearing a pair of cosy socks. Trina, tell me about this word, hygge. We keep being told that it's untranslatable. Can you have a go for us as a Dane?
The hygge? I think it's true in a way, because when you have a word that is so absorbed in your culture and your daily life, it's kind of odd to have to translate it all of a sudden to the whole world. So I think that's where the Danes are right now. We're a bit in shock. What is this about? Why? What's going on?
Everybody's asking.
Yes. And it's a word we use all the time,
okay.
Every day, for a lot of situations. It is a bit more than coziness, because it is such a part of the way we live.
So it's fundamental to Danish culture, and it is in all of the aspects. Can you give me some examples? Like, what can be hygge? Obviously, we know that kind of food and an atmosphere and in a place can be hygge. What about people? Can they be hygge?
Yeah, if they're in a certain mood, they can, but they can also not be. But hygge is about setting the stage of how things should be.
Okay.
It's a social norm. It's a convention. So therefore, it's more than coziness. So it also has some negative sides to it. It's not only getting together, and hygge is all year round. It's not only in the winter. But of course, when it's translated, it seemed like to be the thing with the candle and the food and the hot chocolate and all these, you know, lovely things that we all want in our lives. But it is a way of setting the tone of being together, of hanging out. And Danes are very much into have some pleasant kind of togetherness, if you could say, every day.
But can I ask, if you say you use the word several times a day, would you apply it to a sensibility, a person, beyond an atmosphere?
How
do you get to say it five times a day?
Because you say it like, you say, that was very hyggelig.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a hyggelig time. He was a hyggelig person. You could say that, but you wouldn't say that as much.
Okay, that would be more unusual.
No, not really. But to be a hyggelig person is something. That's a hyggelig person. That's something. He's like, if I think about a hyggelig man, he would be kind of a little bit big. He would feel safe. He would feel somebody you'd trust. You know, it's like.
It's so interesting. Trina, your book is about hygge, but it's mainly a cookbook. And
yes.
It's about comfort eating and Danish comfort food. To what extent is food a part of hygge?
Danes never get together without, you know, eating and drinking something. Coffee is our main thing, but of course alcohol comes into it at some point. When you meet a Dane, we'll not ask you how you are. We don't. When we start to, you know, travel the world, we are always very confused when people ask you how you are, because we will actually answer. And that's the wrong thing to do. So what we would say is, hi, please come in. Would you like a cup of coffee? Our first greeting will be to invite you to enjoy something with us.
Okay, so there's a very big social element to all this then. That's a huge part of it.
Yeah.
Okay.
But it is also about leveling us out. It has a very egalitarian thing to it.
Okay.
Danes is not very big on hierarchy. We are very big of making sure we are all at the same, you know, level. We don't really like people to stick out. So therefore, hygge is also like the social norm that set the stage for now we are all sitting here being equal, having a great time.
It's okay. like a socialist coziness.
There were a lot of jumpers. There are a lot of jumpers in that particular political nook, as far as I'm aware, Helen.
No wonder it's popular.
Is it actually inclusive? Because the sense I get is that it can be a bit exclusionary. You know, you're with old friends or you're with family, because the whole idea is that being comfortable, being familiar. Would you invite a stranger in? Could you, as a stranger, kind of feel hygglic?
Yeah, I think you could. That's a very interesting question, in the sense that Danes are not very good at inviting strangers in. It takes a long time to get really close, I think, to Danes. But if you do, it's for life.
Once you're in, you're in. Yeah. So, Rachel, you're asking there about something that you've written about, I think, is the Scandinavian dream.
What I have written about is, I suppose, the ubiquitousness of IKEA in people's homes, and how somehow IKEA and Scandinavia, and then that's kind of extended vaguely into ideas of Danishness and now hygge, how British culture, you know, it sort of started off quite simply with a couple of tea lights on the mantelpiece, and now it seems to be kind of expanding into this vague, you know, all we know about Scandinavia is that it's kind of a bit north of Germany and it's not France. And we're kind of going into Tiger now, the Danish, well, we call it the Danish pound shop, but it's far more than a Danish pound shop. And the way in which British culture, we're kind of going out and getting all these bits and bobs of the Scandinavian.
So the accoutrement of this kind of imagined lifestyle. What is the appeal, do you think? Susie Orbach, I mean, the lure of the domestic here is very strong, obviously. What are we looking for? What are we searching for?
In a way, we're in a period that's a bit like the 50s. It's a kind of retrenchment of the home or the domestic and of femininity in a particular form, at a moment when we've actually got a world crisis going on, and which we're encouraged to see the outside as incredibly dangerous and rather insecure. And so we've got both the democratization of, we can all have the glamorous house, we can create an internal house that looks like it's for display, that we then move into so we feel like a proper person and we feel like a sophisticated in this world that's so damn confusing.
Okay, so it kind of exists in opposition to a wider context of...
Which we're both part of, but we're also individualising, except we're actually, with the mass marketing of design, which is no bad thing, but we're all at the same time curating ourselves in the same way, if you like.
So curating ourselves.
Yes,
this is the key word, isn't it? And it's digital culture is a big part of this, because I wanted to do this programme initially. I had a conversation with a writer recently, and he was talking about hygge and the trend for hygge kind of coming to the UK. And he sees it as a reaction to digital culture.
But it is and it isn't, isn't it? Because at the same time, when you're preparing your food, you take a snapshot. I don't think it's called a snapshot anymore, but you take a photo, you might not put it on Instagram, but you might say to your friend, look how gorgeous. So that even you yourself are engaging in the act of showing and of displaying, and displaying actually to yourself as much as to anyone else. So that is digital. So it's both playing with digital culture and trying to manage something that's particularly personal and intimate.
It's very interesting, isn't it? It's almost a Zen meditation as well. Like if you craft something or make something without Instagramming it, does it exist? It's the kind of new tree falling in the woods.
Helen Zaltzman, unexamined life is not worth living, but it's a public examination.
Helen Zaltzman, you are a crafter. What do you craft?
Things that I don't know how to make, I suppose. I think that's what's interesting to me. At the moment, my time's very limited for doing anything fun, which is annoying. So usually I craft things if someone needs an unusual item they can't buy.
Such as, come on.
My brother needed some dolls of the cricketers W.G. Grace and Frank Spofforth. And you can't buy those in the toy shops, it seems.
Inexplicably.
I know.
Hard to find.
Also, there's not really a pattern for either of those cricketers online.
Those particular cricketing dolls are... Yeah.
No, so I thought, well, only one way to figure this out is to jump right in.
What materials did you use?
Well, I used an old sheet for the cricket whites. I made a nice moss-stitch beard for WG. They had felt faces. I think the hats were probably felt as well. One of them was known for being very smart, Fred Spofforth. I learned a lot as well whilst making him. He was a very dapper Australian cricketer, and so he always used to wear a tie. So he had a nice ribbon tie in the appropriate colours.
This seems to me to be very much in counterpoint to your professional life, which is as you know, a podcaster. You're there editing. You're writing, working, using screens a lot, I would imagine. So does it feel like a contrast when you're crafting?
The fundamental thing that I enjoy about it is the same, which is at the end there is something that didn't exist at the beginning. Mm-hmm. But yes, the acts of it are quite different. I like the fact that there's this physical engagement when I'm crafting with materials. But in both cases, I taught myself how to do things I didn't know how to do them. And there are these engineering problems in different forms in the podcasting and in the crafting. But it's a shame that the podcasting has ruined my crafting time, I think, because who knows what dead men I could be making effigies of now if I...
But is it required that it be soft materials? I mean, is that the definition of craft? Or could it involve
this
metal or yes. wood?
Yes,
or,
I absolutely
yes,
think so.
You could have a bit of an old car as part of your crafting.
Wood can definitely be, for
yes,
sure.
Yes, I know wood yeah. can, but yeah. I'm trying to think yes. about what materials you might exclude.
Where
I
are the
know
limits?
What this has got to do well, with Hygge, but anyway.
Does it involve tools? Is it to do with the tools?
You mean apart from our hands?
I think apart from, you know, soldering irons,
yeah,
for example.
I think it's small-scale manufacture. Yeah. In answer to your question about materials, I'm wearing some earrings that I bought off Etsy, which is the website where handicrafters yeah. effectively sell their stuff, and they're made out of concrete.
Right. So they are fabulous.
I think concrete can count as craft, right?
For sure, yeah.
I haven't experimented with it yet.
So, Helen, I mean, this is all about creating something that is unique, it's individual, it's handmade, it's homemade, and you know, presumably there is a kind of connection between craft and Hygge. I mean, can you see the appeal, Helen?
There's certainly a personalisation inherent in it. If you're talking about people's homes being so much more populated by IKEA products, then the crafted objects are the antithesis of that in a way. They're these unique objects. And that imprint of individuality. If someone has an object that is a one-off, even if I'd made 100 WG Grace dolls, they'd all probably vary a little from each other.
Trina, the Danish sort of perspective on Hygge that you've brought us so far seems to be very kind of social. As you say, it's egalitarian, it's inclusive. Is this idea of kind of handmade, homemade skill central to it as well?
Both yes and no. I don't think necessarily. It's more about actually creating that atmosphere. Yeah. But it could be in the sense that I think Hygge leads to some kind of authenticity. That is also what people are seeking out. And I think that's one of the real reason why it's on the agenda now is you know, the Danes being the happiest people on the planet, the Scandinavian welfare model everybody's looking at right now. I mean, the whole idea that we actually think that the world is on fire more or less out there, and there's so many things going on we don't understand, and people feel more anxious, and they're looking at other countries and see how are they figuring it out. And you can say about the Scandinavian countries, we have actually figured some things out, especially when it comes to equality, mm-hmm. better balance between home and work and things like that. And I think the hygge ties into that.
Susie?
I suppose the thing that always impresses me from the outside is the fact that you've got a social contract that's about contribution and about engagement. What I wanted to know is, in your, as a cook, is there competition in the cooking, or is it just relished and enjoyed, the individuality of your food prep?
Home cooking is a big thing still. Mm-hmm. Everyday home cooking. I'm not mm-hmm. only talking about, you know, people going out on Saturday and shop right. for 4 hours and cook for 6 hours. I'm talking about the daily meal.
And Trina, mm-hmm. you advocate kind of cooking communally together,
yes.
right?
Yes.
You're a big advocate of that.
Yeah.
Why?
Because I believe it brings you together. It starts a conversation about all the important things in life. And even if you can't speak the same language, you can always cook together.
Mm. And this collective element that you're describing, do you think that's missing from the kind of lifestyle press version of hygge that we're getting over here? Rachel, you know, you kind of think we're missing some elements of it.
I guess what I'm concerned about, in a way, is, you know, books have been written about how IKEA has become emblematic of the modern, and it's that very conscious branding and appropriating of artefacts without any of the history, the cultural value, any idea of the symbolic meaning behind it, you know, that people go out and get the books and kind of maybe talk about them. I actually saw there are some slippers being advertised as Hooglip for £60, which is the antithesis.
Trina,
of what
be
you're
honest,
talking
how
about.
Much did your slippers cost?
I still wear the socks that my grandmother knitted for me.
Now that's serious hygge,
yes,
right?
That's serious hygge.
That's doing it right. Okay, the £60 slippers, not so much for you.
IKEA store is really weird. I just want to say that that's the only place where I never ever go with my husband, because we would have a divorce. I mean, I have a very, very paradoxically kind of relationship with IKEA, because I was brought up with it, and I don't get the whole idea of it. Sorry.
Is it all the capitals?
World.
It can feel quite shouty to me. All everything's in capitals. It's like, whoa, okay, settle down.
I do have to say that I knew that my first marriage had come to an end when we were ordering a wardrobe in Bristol IKEA.
That's I a think great the book title.
Rachel,
yes.
It is. It also feels like the beginning of a film.
Yeah. Okay, maybe not Disney,
definitely with a happy ending at the end. I mean, Rachel, let's talk a bit then about the meaning of home, because it's obviously culturally and historically specific. We often describe home as a sanctuary, but apparently that's a relatively modern idea. When does that kind of idea come in?
The conscious creation of home as sanctuary came about towards the end of the 18th century. Really, it's tied up with industrialisation, profit. You know, Protestant spirit of capitalism.
Enterprise.
That somehow there had to be an other to that. And that was consciously created, the angel of the hearth, by white Anglo-Saxon Protestant men with, you know, the woman at home, and her duty was to look after her family and to exhibit virtue, purity, piety and domesticity.
Not doing very well on any of those. I'm just that checklist. Fail. I mean, so before that, you're saying that there wasn't this kind of separation between the private sphere and the public sphere in the same way, this kind of gendered separation.
The change wasn't sudden, and obviously industrialisation happened at different times in different places. But if you think about the early modern era, the workshop could be in the back of the house, it could be in the cellar, you might have the loft above, you know, for
and
the
1700s,
silk
1800s?
Yeah. Yeah, and then what happened was, as, you know, manufacturing stopped being craft, really, and became industry, you start to have this split. And whereas previously everything had been tangled together, and as a woman you were in charge of the house and household management, but that was actually quite a complex business, that gradually, you know, there's this move out to the suburbs, and your man has kind of fled to the city to have this quite masculine existence, and then comes home at night to the little woman who's made this sanctuary of religious, virtuous, domestic perfection.
So that's a kind of archetype, from a kind of 20th century archetype. Where are we at now, and how are things changing?
It's interesting to get back to what Susie was talking about, you know, that what happened with the first and in particular the Second World Wars was women were going out to work also for a number of reasons, none of which are absolutely certain. Family size had shrunk, so people were just having two. It was respectable to have two children rather than sort of acres of them spreading up into the attics and down to the cellars. And then after the Second World War, particularly in North America and in Britain, this idea of having the wife at home looking after her man became all entangled with patriotism. And so these women suddenly found themselves back at home in the suburbs, probably necking Valium when that came along.
You could smell it off them.
Susie, really?
You could smell the farmer on the women.
So, Susie, you're talking about what I think Betty Friedan referred to as the problem with no name, which mm-hmm. is the phrase from the feminist.
Which was competing at the same time with Keeping Up with the Joneses in Britain. So you've got attempts to make the home, this sanctuary, be something that's as competitive as the marketplace.
So it's a kind of parallel.
So that women themselves became involved in a game of competition. It's really quite interesting.
A kind of game of competition. Yes, they moved in tandem, didn't they? The production in the workplace and what we're seeing, you know, the new consumerism.
Right, so once you're out of the munitions factories, mm-hmm. you know, give us back our wives and sweethearts, you then have to recognise that they actually are used to the sophisticated competition or the camaraderie. So you have a virtual camaraderie, don't you? You don't actually have a hygge camaraderie. I mean, maybe you give them a radio or a television serial to watch, but and maybe you have this insulting thing called a coffee clutch, which was
what deemed, a coffee clutch?
That That's was when the women got together because they were sort of a bit lonely and they needed to discuss their recipes children and their
coffee
sewing.
Morning, yeah.
Everything that we now actually think, oh, that's really interesting. That was women's culture and how fabulous and extraordinary. But there's all these different strains going on, I think.
Trina, you want to come in?
Yeah, I think when you talk about consumerism, the hygge thing is quite important because that is kind of the opposite, whereas it, of course, it's played on for everybody who wants to sell anything. I know that. But if you talk about something being hyggeligt, you'd have a good example of saying that, you know, we can't afford to do this and that, but instead we'll go home and have a hyggeligt time together. You use it a lot like that. So even, you know, up, you know, through the 60s and 70s. And so it became something that would be, we might not be able to afford this, but that's okay because we are so good at having a hyggeligt time instead.
You don't need to spend the money.
Yeah.
Susie, I mean, a home is an emotional space as well as a physical one, isn't it? How central is it to our emotional health?
For some of us, it's absolutely critical. But there are people for whom home is actually quite frightening. And they don't want to be there. And they don't know what to do with themselves when they are there. Or they want to get away from the children. Or historically, men haven't known what their place is. So I don't actually think we can say what is home. We could probably go around this table and say what's home for each of us. Mm. But it's sold to us as the place of privacy and of truth, authenticity, as you were saying, and of self-expression. But honestly, it's also a place of drudgery and difficulty, hard work, and you know, for me, enormous pleasures. I work from home and I also love my home.
Let me bring in Helen Zaltzman here because, you know, I know that you are currently between abodes, should we say?
Yes,
Helen, how should we phrase it? You had to pack everything up and stay with your brother for a bit.
Yeah, my our landlord wanted to move back into his flat, fine, because it's his flat. And we'd been living there for 10 years, so it felt very much like our home. So at the moment, we're living in my brother's attic, which is very homely, but it's not my home. And nearly all of my stuff is in a storage unit in South London. Is that my home? Probably not. And weirdly, I wasn't very pleased when he announced that he was returning after 10 years of us living there. But now that it's happened, the lack of attachment, I feel I'm actually fine with. In a way, I feel like the home that I now seek isn't necessarily a permanent residence, or at least for the next couple of years. It might be moving around and interacting with various different people. And I get that sense from their proximity rather than the physical space.
So what are the objects that you've kind of carried with you that constitute home? What makes home for you?
Oh, that's a very good question. I have a large collection of square scarves, so I brought a good few dozen of those. But, you know, that's the capsule collection, right? and my husband brought some of his guitars. Again, his capsule collection of guitars is still a lot of guitars by most people's standards of guitars. But I think if there were no instruments at all, then it would feel like we were staying in a travelodge or something. But I've only got 20 books. And wow. That, I know.
Ugh. And what about the stuff that's in storage? Are you missing it? Because this is the thing, when you move, I think, and most of us have probably had an experience where we've moved house and maybe you haven't unpacked for a bit or something, but, you know, those boxes of stuff that you spend ages packing up and you think it's indispensable and then you just forget what's in it, don't you?
Is now that I'm just thinking, what is the point of all that stuff? Except the other day it was getting cold, because also the heating doesn't work in the house that now I live in. And I was thinking, my favourite winter mug's in storage, and I don't even know whether I'll see it for a year or where I'll be unpacking it. And that felt a bit weird, and that's just a stupid, that's a £2 mug. It's not even a good mug, it's just my favourite winter mug.
I think you'll understand that, Trina, because I've read your book and I know that you're quite particular about your mugs.
Yes. That's like I have a morning one, I have an afternoon, I have one for coffee, one for tea.
Okay, and they've got to be the perfect one for the perfect time.
Yes.
This sense of ritual then about eating and drinking for you, is that the kind of ritual element of dining important?
Yes, it is. But I'm very fond of my home, but I'm not attached to it like we're talking about.
Okay.
And I think it has to do with my childhood that I was, you know, I lived in a lot of communes with my very left-wing parents who was trying to do things in a different ways. So I can live anywhere. I can live in a suitcase. I travel a lot. I don't mind it, but I need to have a cup of tea in the morning, even though I'm not British, I'm Danish. So, and if I go to a hotel, I will find my favorite cup right away. And I'll ask for it if it's not there the next day, or if I rent, so I have these things where I try to kind of recreate what I think is important.
I mean, I suppose it comes back to meaning. I've just moved home, so I've got the boxes. I'm not in a position to unpack them yet because, you know, a couple of thousand of them are books. I mean, a couple of thousand of volumes of books, right?
Okay, not a couple of thousand boxes.
No, and kitchen.
Susie, this is out of control. This hoarding's got to stop.
The two things that matter to me, the kitchen and books. I mean, apart from people, which are very important. But what interested me in this transition was that despite the fact that I was moving to somewhere that was very much appealed to me architecturally and design-wise, I really felt so attached to the place that I was living in that I thought I would mourn it. And the minute that I got into this new place, I thought, I don't even want to go back there. I have no feeling for it. It's kind of over for me. And that was a big shock. I don't know if it relates to your story.
Yes, exactly the same. Yeah.
I was really surprised because I thought, I am a homebody. I go out in my forays, but I see people at home. And I write from home, so I see patients, and I'm at home a lot. Mm. And I thought that it was my physical environment was so important to me. Yet I was I found myself being able to just kiss it goodbye.
So home is its spirit,
so
as well as a physical.
It's internalized in some way. I think maybe it's because I'm so ancient at this point that whatever home means, it is part of me, and it has come with me to be expressed in a new form. But I had a surprise.
But maybe it's also because we're lucky it wasn't a traumatic removal from home.
Correct.
That we had some
dominion.
Exactly
so.
So let's talk about the idea of kind of opening up your life at home to the wider world. Trina, you've done that with your book. Did you worry at all about the way it would be received and people perhaps disagreeing or judging, especially if you're saying, this is what hygge means to me, and it's something that's such a big part of Danish culture?
Nope, not at all, because that's my way of living, and I'm not being judgmental of other people. But of course, I come from a culture where a dining table is really, really important. We don't have homes really without a dining table, and the whole idea of having people over for dinner, both casually and spontaneously, and is such a big part of how we do it. And I think it's a great story, and I think I really, really, truly believe that in that sense, the Scandinavians have something to offer to the world and say, you don't have to work 50, 60 hours a week. It's pretty important to pick up your children around 4 or 5 o'clock and go home and have dinner with them and speak to them. And I don't really care what you cook. I mean, it doesn't have to be, you know, 2 hours organic meal forever and ever. You can also just buy it, you know, just cook it and sit down and eat and enjoy yourself or your friends or, you know. So, and I believe, actually, like really naively, that if we did that a lot and sat down, we could change the world.
But
I do.
You think it's... I mean, I suppose the Scandinavian bit is finishing work early, because what you're describing is incredibly Jewish. It's incredibly Middle Eastern. It's incredibly Indian. I grew up in a household where anybody who walked through the door was fed, whether they actually wanted to be or not, because that's what you did. And I was in shock when I went to other people's houses and was asked to wait in the sitting room while they finished their dinner. I mean, I was...
Oh, my God.
I just didn't understand it. It wasn't what I came from.
Sure.
So what I think is very different about what you're talking about is that positioned in the Western world where working from 6 a.m. to God knows what time is now privileged as being the way to be. Your bit of the continent has challenged that.
And I think we can put food back into that discussion and time to hygge. And I think the most important thing that we bring to the table right now is that it's socially acceptable for both men and women to get up at their work around 4 o'clock and say, I have to pick up the kids and go home and cook.
Permission to slow down and permission to opt out of the kind of busy commercial, you know, to work.
So that's kind of like the Italian cheetahs, the slow
food movement.
And also this egalitarianism in parenting, because I know, for example, my husband and I shared our parental leave when we adopted our daughter when she was 9 months old. So he took the first half, I took the second half. And his time off was greeted with astonishment. You know, we work in a school of social sciences, and even, you know, the social scientists were going, oh my God, you know, what are you doing? Because it's that idea of career and getting on.
My partner at the time was asked, are you sure it's your baby?
What?
Even though, because he was the first person to take parental leave.
Trina, they're talking about the work-life balance and the split between work and home.
It's just fantastic.
To what extent do we think that work is encroaching on home now? Because this is another problem of, you know, digital culture and the mobile, you know, because work is always there. Email is always there. You're always contactable. Rachel, what do you think about that?
It's problematic because, you know, there's this concept in geography, you know, of the third space, which always used to be, you know, somewhere like the coffee shop or these liminal spaces, which are quite one thing or the other. But what's happening is that people are working from home all the time. I can check my emails in the middle of the night with this mobile working environment. I actually researched the opposite, which I've called homing from work, because with this sort of blurring of boundaries, you know,
checking Facebook while you're happening, should be doing something.
Well, my dear, I didn't speak to anyone who did that. but you know, I have my slippers at work because it seems utterly peculiar. I'm spending a lot of time in this place. Of course, I'm going to put my slippers on. But the way in which people can do that with something as small as a mug. You know, even in a hot desking environment, you've got your mug, you've got your cardi on the back of the chair, and that place is yours for a time.
So does your research show that we're doing that more, that we're personalising work more and blurring the boundaries between the two places?
If people can. For some people, that is very difficult, because what's happened with this, you know, this idea of mobile working, you know, I can go and set up in any of the branded coffee shops or on that sofa over there, is that people are losing space. I know in the BBC, you know, there was a lot of difficulty when everything suddenly went open plan and, you know, programmes started losing their studios where they'd hunkered down and hung their Mexican hats on the clock and so on, as I noticed you've done in Woman's Hour.
That is the hat of joy. Occasionally people have to pop it on when they need to perk up.
The hat of joy.
It's a secret.
It's that maybe what we're getting back to is, you know, just what people have been talking about home not being a place somewhere to be mourned as we move on to the next, or chucked out of our place. But it's more to do with, I think this is hygge actually, the here and now, mindfulness. I know, for example, work I did with refugees, asylum seekers who are destitute, is that they felt at home for the 2 hours in a drop-in centre when they were just talking over a cup of tea, perhaps preparing food together. Mm. You know, that was a kind of forced placelessness. But actually, maybe that's what it would be a good idea to get back to, rather than this obsession with territorial ownership of space.
Well, is togetherness a good enough word?
Yeah, but togetherness is also it's part of it. Uh-huh. But you can hygge alone as well.
You can hygge alone. So does that mean that because you feel bountiful inside and you feel content enough and warm enough and...
I think in the British depictions that I've seen in magazines and stuff of hygge, it is a very solitary activity as far as it's being portrayed to us. It's generally speaking a lady in cosy socks holding a coffee with two hands, like holding a coffee like it's a bowl of cereal in a way that I don't think anyone ever actually drinks coffee that way, but that seems to
burn
be...
their hands.
Yes.
Does it require a slang kit?
Or a Christmas jumper, but at any time of year.
Yeah.
I'm up for both those things, I've got to be honest.
No,
hygge is kind of part of this new domesticity. Susie, what do you make of that? I think of it as kind of keep calm and have a cupcake culture.
You don't think it was the selling of women back, some aspect of femininity back to women in a slightly more, you know, post-superwoman, which we never actually got beyond, which was the Thatcher rip-off of second-wave feminism, where we had to have it all and be it all and do it all at the same time. Was there something about that domesticity, and maybe Nigella unwittingly or wittingly was part of this, was we will make it ours in a different way. We'll make it rounded. We won't make it with hard joints. We will make it bountiful and sharing. And part of that story, of course, was this is damn frightening, those women out there in the world. We're going to tell them their place, and then, you know, we're going to tell them what their bodies have to look like, and then we're going to tell them exactly how they have to perform femininity. And then you get Nigella, who's both subversive and non-subversive, because she says, no, you're not going to do it that way. We're going to actually have that delicious stuff that you're telling us we're not allowed to have. We're going to lick it. We're going to wear it. We're going to be sensual, and we're going to be as big as we are or as small as we are. It's irrelevant. We are going to take up the space. So I think there was something kind of transgressive about the counterpoint to the domestic that was the domestic goddess.
Maybe to my shame, I have never seen a Nigella teleprogramme or the Great British Bake Off
I've never seen the Bake Off, which is really shameful because I just watched it waiting downstairs here.
Was it good?
It's completely riveting because it's craft.
Aha. Uh-huh.
It's about the capacity of the ordinary and the pleasure in the ordinary. I mean, as somebody who does cook, but I can't bake, I'm really fascinated by another cookery skill and the interest and engagement with that. And this seems to me to be so touching and so engaging because you're really interested in how they're doing it, how they're actually solving the problems that they're encountering as they're preparing the dough.
It is called the cult of domesticity.
Correct.
Cult was actually shortened originally, historically, from culture. It is a cult. It's all on Pinterest. It's on Instagram. And I'm just wondering, as endearing as the Great British Bake Off might be, for example, is it just another way of branding, of putting in inverted commas, everyday life, what people have just been doing and are doing, and then someone goes, oh, hang on a minute, let's get some books
but
and TV programmes out
maybe
of
Maybe it is, but maybe for the few minutes that I saw, what really interested me is that it's reflective of something about cultural change, which is it wasn't white, it wasn't female, it wasn't young.
So this is the Bake Off.
There were a couple of guys, two non-whites, and there's Mary Berry. She's not a youngster. There was something different about it that spoke to, let's recognise cultural change.
Okay, so it's representing cultural change, but it's also merchandising it.
Correct.
You know, what are we saying? What is it, 4 million or 4 billion? I lose track of the noughts, you know, because you've been talking about first, second wave, third wave, we're on to fourth wave feminism. And with each rolling of the tide, you know, at first it was just white middle class women. Gradually, more and more women are being kind of incorporated into feminism. But at the same time, we have this kind of backlash, the cult of domesticity, that is incorporating ethnicity.
I agree, but Rachel,
class.
There's one point that I really think that second waivers, of which obviously I am, we didn't want to put down the whole notion of the personal, the familial, the friendship, the home, the raising of children. We actually wanted to say, no, those are interesting topics. We were brought up to think they were really uninteresting topics if we went to university. And the women talked about that and the men talked about real stuff. And then we worked out, no, this is real stuff. This is just as real as everything else that's been talked about. So, yes, I agree with you. But I also don't, because I think there's something about the domestic that is very, very important and needs not to be downgraded.
I mean, it's absolutely right. There are kind of dualities left, right and centre with all this stuff, aren't there? Obviously, and Helen, this seems like a good point to ask you about it, because obviously we have this kind of strange mix, don't we, where we do have such a big kind of industry has sprung up, but the popularity of craft, and you're a crafter, but then it's in some ways, you know, the whole point of it is to make something yourself, for it to be homemade, but it's more expensive to knit a jumper than to buy a jumper. I mean, how do you wrestle with all this?
I think it was easy for me because it was just something I was raised doing by parents who made a lot of their own stuff, partly out of necessity because they didn't have a lot of money. Like, they used to mend all their own things. I was like, how do my parents know how to mend roofs and cut down trees? That's amazing. I still don't know how to do those things. I remember a few years ago when the trend was starting for a lot of workshops, a lot of Hindus that were going to make bunting. And there was some craft supplement with one of the weekend papers, and it was saying, hey, knit in public on the tube or something so everyone can see. And I was like, no, that is not what it's about. It's solitary. It's for your own self-improvement. This was before really the visual element of social media had really caught on. I suppose a lot of the commodification of it, it's a gateway for some people. I think a lot of people look at stuff and they think, I don't know how to do that. And unlike me, they don't think, let's try it. They think, I'm not allowed. So it's in a way permission for them. And I think a lot of people, they might buy a knitting kit and then get very frustrated when it's slow and they don't do it perfectly first off and they give up. But the ones who persevere, that's just their starting point. So I think that's quite a positive thing if it gets people to discover that thing themselves.
And where are the lines for you? Because it's a really funny one. I was thinking about this in the run-up to this, because my mum used to be, she was a seamstress, and she used to make clothes, and she used to do it for money because she didn't have any money. So when she was a student, she did that. And then she hated doing anything like that as she got older. And for her, it kind of harkened back. You know, I remember asking her when I was in a band to make me some clothes for the stage because I was so tall, I couldn't get these ridiculous kind of gold trousers that I wanted or whatever it was. And so she made me these, but I remember her really not enjoying it because it just reminded her of kind of, you know, being poor. It's complicated for people, I think. Where are the lines for you, Helen, in, you know, what kind of counts as craft and what counts as commerce? Because we have this kind of this authenticity industry around us.
It's so interesting what you're saying, because I would put in to the question to Helen relating to your mum, and when is it drudgery?
Yes.
Because when those frozen foods came in initially, that was really helpful for women. That is a form of relief or liberation. So I'm interested in the drudgery, craft, commerce argument.
That is one of the really big paradoxes because nowadays the middle class, we are seeking this authenticity all the time, and we're doing it in a lot in food. I mean, so many things goes on in food. Like, now we can go to fancy restaurants and eat, you know, the pigtail and the feet and everything, and my grandmother was so happy she didn't have to eat it anymore. You know, because it showed that they were not poor anymore.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think and I'm old enough to have been with my grandmother. There's actually some recipes in my book, which takes 2 days to make. And I can remember like having it once, because then my grandmother found out she could buy it in the new supermarket that just opened. And she was so happy she didn't have to do it again. So I think that is the paradox, because the craftsmanship and the cooking and all of that for the middle class now, that is for us a way to kind of connect with a lot of things that we have lost. And how do we tackle all of that,
yeah,
you know, without being pressure, you know?
Well, I think if you're lucky enough to have a craft or adore cooking or anything in the domestic, then it's really delicious. But yeah. if you don't, it's a lot of difficulty.
Yeah. Helen, what do you think?
Well, at the moment, I'm wearing a dress that I made, and I don't think that makes it or me better. It's just I liked the
fabric. It is an awesome dress, though. Come on, be honest.
I mean, morally, I'm better because of the dress.
Obviously.
No, it's just I like the fabric. It has a pattern on it. It's sort of a paint-by-numbers of some stags. And because I'm bigger and it's harder to find clothes and I need to cover my body in garments. So it's really a practical thing. And when people say, oh, where's that dress from? Because they, too, like the pictures of stags. And I say, oh, I made it. I'm not going, yeah, I made it. It's just the answer to where I got it from. But I feel like it comes across that way, that there's some kind of superiority that actually I don't feel. And then there's that thing as well, when you're young, it can be quite mortifying to wear homemade garments.
Yes. Yes.
Like, there's a tipping point of your age where it's not nice to wear a jumper that your nan knitted you anymore. Yes. It's like, oh, embarrassing.
Christmas jumper is mortifying until it's the most thoughtful gift.
When does it come back in? What's the age bracket?
Well, this is it. It's when you've got over needing to be exactly like everybody else in order to feel it's safe enough to risk having your own identity. I mean, that is the problem of being an adolescent, isn't it? You've all got to look the same and be the same in order to differentiate at all.
Susie, thank goodness you're here. I think that's all we've got time for, guys. But one final question. I mean, hibernation season is upon us. I'm going to be onesying up with a box set. Would any of my guests like to share?
I think that's a bit old-fashioned box set.
I'm sorry.
Yeah. I'm using it in as a metonym.
As generic.
As a metonym for
okay.
I am going to be downloading some series of some shows.
How will my guests be spending winter at home? Would anybody like to share? Trina?
I'm going to have a lot of hot chocolates and cinnamon buns.
That sounds all right. Helen Zaltzman?
There's a patchwork quilt I started a year ago and I'm only 40% into, and it was commissioned by a friend, so I need to get on with it.
What about you, Rachel?
I will be engaging in making craft with my three-year-old, which will mainly involve a lot of glue, not on the paper, but on me and the table.
Perfect, standard. And Susie?
I hope to be putting my books away and I'll be playing with my grandson.
That sounds marvellous. Thank you very much indeed to my guests tonight, Helen Zaltzman, Rachel Hurdley, Susie Orbach and Trina Hahnemann. Thank you all.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.